This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 4th of December 2010, and today I'm honored to be talking to John Hankey, the director of the landmark documentaries Dark Legacy, George Bush and the Murder of John F. Kennedy, and The Assassination of JFK Jr. John Hankey, it's a pleasure to have you on the program today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, perhaps we could start by hearing from you about your background and what motivated you to begin making these documentaries in the first place.
How much time do we have?
as much as you need.
Very seriously.
Very seriously, we have as much as an hour.
Okay, which is not very much time. I mean, we could easily do three. But I guess I was 20 years old, and I felt, I think, more or less intuitively that what I was learning in college was not what I needed to be learning, that it was irrelevant to what was going on. This was in 1970, and, you know, was in the middle of Watergate and the Vietnam War. I dropped out of college in order to get an education, and very relatively quickly, I ran into somebody who showed me a copy of the Zapruder film. And at that point, and this is 30 years ago, is it 38 years ago? No, it can't possibly be that long ago. It would have been about 1972. I saw this Zapruder film, and it's just overwhelming. And I had always been a really good student, and history had always been my favorite subject. And I saw this Zapruder film, and I said, I don't know anything, right? That is to say, I don't know for sure anything. If everything that I've been told about the Kennedy assassination was a lie, what reason do I have to do any of the things that I have ever been taught during the course of my life? And so I have, since that time, and I'm not anywhere near done, started reexamining all of the assumptions that I had been taught to be reasonable and acceptable and probable. And in the next couple of years, in 1972, it was easy. In 1972, you could easily read everything that had been written on the Kennedy assassination, because there wasn't very much stuff. There were four or five books, maybe slightly more than that. But at this point, there are millions of pages, so it's much more difficult. But in any case, at that time, I made myself an expert, and I went around and I did presentations. I went to my old high school, and I went to my favorite teacher, and I said, I've learned all this stuff, and I want to talk to you. And I talked to him, and then he said, well, come into the classroom and put on a lesson for the students. And I did, and then I went to the college that I had attended, UC Santa Cruz, the college that I had dropped out, and I put on a presentation there, and I got together with some people, and we put on a presentation at UCLA. And that pretty much went on about my business opposing the Vietnam War, I suppose. I mean, it wasn't, I didn't stop being political, and what I learned about the Kennedy assassination very, very much influenced my vision of what was going on in Vietnam and what were the immoral and illegal bases of that war. And in the process of all of this, right, it has come out on various levels by various authors, and it was out at that time that Kennedy had opposed the war, and that was the reason that he was killed. Peter Dale Scott, all that time ago, wrote a book called The War Conspiracy, in which he delineated not only that Kennedy had been murdered in order to make it possible to wage the Vietnam War, but that the Pentagon Papers was a fraud, because it didn't say that. It said very, very much the opposite. Anyhow, eventually I got a job teaching. I'm skipping a lot, but that's okay. I got a job teaching for the LA Unified School District, and I was teaching my kids about the Kennedy assassination. We would just analyze the material that was out there and pick it apart, right? Point to the holes and point to the obvious alternate conclusions, the obvious alternate conclusions to the ones that we were being encouraged to accept by Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite, I'm trying to think, it's got to be about 25 years ago, narrated a special on PBS called Who Shot President Kennedy? And the Zapruder film had just been released, right? The Zapruder film was supposed to be locked up for 25 years, and on the 25th anniversary, the Zapruder film, for people who don't know, was shot by an amateur during the assassination and shows very dramatically and graphically the president's brains being blown out the back of his head and his body being thrown violently backward. Anyhow, so I was teaching my kids. We were analyzing this Walter Cronkite narrated video where he would show you this dramatic evidence and then tell you that you hadn't seen what you had just seen. And it was, you know, a very, very interesting and worthwhile lesson, and I was very satisfied with it. And I had heard that George Bush had been mentioned in an FBI memo written by Hoover, but I had heard of it, and I hadn't heard very much, that the memo had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. But I hadn't gone the 9 yards to find out. Like I said, I was teaching the lesson that I was teaching, and I was satisfied with it, and John Kennedy Jr.'s plane went into the water. And so I began, I heard early in the morning, probably 7 o'clock in the morning, I heard a news report. I was on my way to a conference of all of these hardworking teachers, and I heard a report that his plane was missing, and I was very, very concerned. I haven't been to church in 4 years, but I said a prayer for him and went to this conference and got thoroughly distracted and went home and went out to dinner with my wife, and we went to our favorite restaurant and we ordered our favorite foods, and I looked up at the monitor and I saw these planes crisscrossing in the water, and then I saw Dan Rather come on the screen, and they brought the food, and I was sick to my stomach. I could not eat the food. I felt like I was going to throw up, because Dan Rather had been a local newsman, CBS newsman in Dallas at the time of the assassination. When the president was killed, every news agency in the world sent an army of reporters to Dallas, and so you have an assembled army of news reporters, and they found out that this film had been shot, that the Zapruder film had been shot, and they were waiting to get their hands on it, and they were told by the FBI that they were not going to be allowed to get their hands on it, and all of them looked at the spokespeople and said, "You killed him. If you're not going to let us see the film, you killed him." And we can't believe anything about what he said, and, you know, we're going to start our own investigations. And so the FBI scrambled and said, "Well, we'll let one representative of the news people look at the film, and they will come out and tell you that it says what we say it says." And they chose Rather, and Rather went in and looked at it and came out and said, and you can actually find this on the internet, his voice was recorded saying that the president's head clearly jerks forward as a result of the fatal shot to his head. And as anybody knows who's seen it, his head does not clearly jerk forward. It's his head and his entire body are violently thrown backward. In any case, at that point, I had a visceral reaction, a gut reaction that said John Kennedy Jr. was murdered by the same people who killed his father. And I began investigating that, and I won't go through all of that. At this point in time, I own every article that was published in the next 2 weeks in the United States. I have in my possession. And I got my hands on every video, and I got my hands on the government report, the National Transportation Safety Board report, and I poured through all of that, and I put together all of that evidence, and it became more and more and more and more obvious that he was murdered. It became more and more obvious how he was murdered. What didn't become more and more obvious is why he was murdered. He was not planning to run for Senate. He was happy being a magazine owner. That was my observation. He had printed a couple of extreme articles that, in fact, I've done a lot of research on this topic, I've read the book by his editor, who says that he urged him not to print an article alleging that the Prime Minister of Israel was murdered by the Mossad. And he printed an article by Oliver Stone, and Oliver Stone throws off in this article. The article was about how political assassinations occur, period, and that no one should look askance at Stone or anyone else for suggesting that Kennedy's assassination was a conspiracy, because all of these other assassinations that he points to were conspiracies, and he goes into depth about how Napoleon was assassinated, that he was poisoned by the British, and the French had exhumed the body, and they found arsenic in Napoleon's hair follicles. He was poisoned by the British. Well, that's an assassination, and obviously it was a conspiracy. But Oliver Stone throws this line off, and John Kennedy Jr. published it, and anybody who's familiar with the Kennedy assassination knows that no member of the Kennedy family has ever alleged that there was a conspiracy in the murder of any member of the Kennedy assassination, any member of the Kennedy family. Anyhow, I had all of this evidence that John Kennedy Jr. was murdered, but I didn't have a lot of evidence about who might possibly have killed him. That is to say, I could speculate, but I didn't have anything hardcore. And I guess I'll wind this up. I woke up one morning at, I think, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I remember jerking awake violently and heard the echo in my brain that what my brain was stewing on was that the father killed the father, the son killed the son. And I had this background information that Bush Sr. had been involved in the murder of John Kennedy Sr., and I ran to my computer, and at that time I had this magnificent program put together by Dow Jones that read, I don't know if it's available anymore, every newspaper and magazine on the planet going back 10 years, and you could immediately access any of them. I typed in the George Bush and the date in order to determine where George Bush Jr. was on the day that John Kennedy Jr. died, and he was flipping pancakes at 9 o'clock in the morning, maybe 8, and he disappeared at 9 or 10, and he was gone for 3 days. He and his campaign attracted the attention of the news media, who took the approach, in response to John Kennedy Jr.'s death, they took the approach that George Bush Jr. and John Kennedy Jr. were the two living sons of any living president. And they ran to his campaign headquarters to interview him to get his reaction. And Kathleen Harris, his campaign manager, said, I don't know. He's not here. And they said, where is he? And when will he be back? And she said, I don't know. And he was gone for 3 days. He came back. He was running for president. He was behind in New Hampshire. He was, like I said, he was running for president. He was in Iowa flipping pancakes in the morning. He's behind in New Hampshire. And not only does he not campaign in this crucial weekend in the run-up to New Hampshire, but he completely disappears in a manner that his staff is either unable or unwilling to answer questions as to what his whereabouts are. I don't know if I have anything more powerfully incriminating about George Bush Jr. than that, other than the fact that we have learned since that he's a war criminal of sizable proportions. But I think I've answered your question.
I think you have, and you've gotten into so many of the issues which I think you bring out so excellently in your documentaries. And of course, you have that poetic line, the father killed the father and the son killed the son. Did that come to you in the Henry Kissinger voice that you used in the documentary?
I don't believe that it did. I'm sorry,
I
left one little thing out, which is that, so then I really assembled the information for the second movie first. But it was very, very clear to me that in assembling the evidence against George Bush Jr., I just explained it to you, it's nothing. And if you don't know the mountain of evidence linking George Bush Sr. to the assassination of John Kennedy Sr., then the evidence that I have against John Kennedy Jr., against George Bush Jr., is nothing. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's so weak that it's not worth talking about. But when you pair that with the overwhelming evidence against the father, then it becomes the fact that the son in this incredibly intense situation his whereabouts are unknown. It turns out that he was, unless it's a planted story, he was at the Bohemian Grove in California. That is, he showed up there very late on Saturday. Anyhow, the murder was committed on Friday night. The idea, the notion to use Henry Kissinger came to me, I think when Kissinger was appointed to be the head of the 9/11 Commission. I'm trying to think why it was that I would have, and maybe it was just a gut feeling that Kissinger was the most senior, most evil advisor, and maybe it came to me in Kissinger's voice. I didn't make a note of why I chose Kissinger, I'd assembled all the evidence, but I hadn't produced the videos before 9/11. So I did have that information. So certainly, absolutely, 9/11, many of the most significant details incriminating the Bush family and the Cheney family and that entire establishment were well known to me, and Kissinger's ties to all of them were well known to me. So that I think that that is probably what made me choose Kissinger, especially the fact that he would have been appointed to head the 9/11 Commission. It's a point that I make. I think it is in at the end of the John Kennedy Jr. video, which I haven't watched in several years. I throw in this long, very, very detailed explanation of a number of things, and I think it might. That explanation might be in that long, detailed explanation. And I believe that I make this comparison in that explanation, that it is almost beyond a doubt that Alan Dulles was the chief administrator of the assassination of John Kennedy Sr. And he was then put to head the Warren Commission. So it strikes me that if it would be par for the course, right, it would make automatic sense that if Henry Kissinger were appointed to head the 9/11 Commission, that it was because he was the godfather, he was the chief head planner of, and I don't mean that he did all of the detailed work, but I mean that when I say godfather, I mean it in that sense, that he sat at the head of the table of a bunch of other people when I did the heavy lifting in arranging 9/11, and that if he was that person, it strikes me that it would have made sense that he would have also. I see the murder of John Kennedy Jr. as being very much linked to 9/11. I see it as a dry run for 9/11 in a number of ways. That is to say, the conspiracy between the FAA and the Pentagon in the murder of John Kennedy Jr. is very, very obvious. And the conspiracy between the FAA and the Pentagon on November 11th is very, very obvious. So it's very much the same players, and if Kissinger was supervising them on 9/11, which I think he clearly was, then it made sense to me that he would have been supervising them on July 17th, 1999, when John Kennedy Jr. was murdered.
Well, that's absolutely right, and I don't think many of my listeners would really question the use of Kissinger in that, because I think my listeners are well acquainted with his role in so many of the types of events that have unfortunately shaped our world for the worse over the last several decades now. It's such an overwhelming amount of evidence that you've compiled in Dark Legacy and in your movie about George Bush Sr. and his role in the JFK assassination that it could be quite overwhelming for some people. And I certainly hope my listeners have checked it out by now, as I've referred to this documentary numerous times on the podcast in the past. But for those who haven't yet checked it out, I obviously wouldn't want you to go into a great summary of all of the points. But what do you think are some of the most important pieces of information that at least got you into researching George Bush's role in the JFK assassination?
Sure. Rather than the ones that got me into it, let me just point to the ones that are astonishingly obvious and the most powerful. And you can make the case pretty simply and clearly, although I have to admit that I've been attacked recently by some very, very reputable people, which is rather chilling, right? That is to say, if the evidence is as clear and overwhelming as I suggest it is, and you agree with me, and I did lots and lots and lots of people who agree with me. Then if somebody's challenging that, it really, I think, throws into sharp question their credibility. And if this is a person who has, over the years, built up enormous credibility, then I think that there's also a powerful suggestion that this person is not who they have been pretending to be over the years. Anyhow, there's a book written by Mark Lane, and I'm shocked and pleased to note when I was forced to go back, right? Like, as I say, I've been challenged, you're saying all this ridiculous stuff. And I said, I got it from Mark Lane. Mark Lane wrote, I think, the first major book on the Kennedy assassination, Rush to Judgment. But I hope your listeners get out a pencil and write this down. He also wrote a book called Plausible Denial. And everything that I get, all the major points, are from Plausible Denial. And in Plausible Denial, Lane makes the point that, I'm sorry, let me put a period at that sentence and start it over. I'm trying to remember the year, and I'm not going to come up with it. There was Spotlight Magazine, and it turns out a New Jersey newspaper also, but Spotlight Magazine published an article in which they quoted a CIA memorandum from Jesus Angleton, who was the chief of operations, to Richard Helms, who was the head of the CIA at the time, saying E. Howard Hunt, who was the head of the Watergate burglars, was in Dallas on the day of the assassination and was involved. The Senate committee, or was it the House committee, and I'm not sure which, and I think they were acting rather simultaneously, so it doesn't really matter, has discovered this, and it's going to come out, and we should hang him out to dry. We didn't have anything to do with it. Let him get hung out to dry. He was involved. Let him be hung out to dry. E. Howard Hunt sued for slander, and the Spotlight Magazine hired Mark Lane, who was an attorney and a successful attorney, as well as one of the people writing about the Kennedy assassination. They hired Mark Lane to represent them, and Mark Lane represented them and won. And Lane walked out after the trial was over and listened to the forewoman of the jury speaking to the reporters, and listened to her say to the reporters that the reason that they found the magazine innocent was because they had found Hunt guilty. They had found that the preponderance of the evidence showed that Hunt had in fact been involved in the assassination. And so what Spotlight printed was not in error. And there was an enormous amount of evidence presented in the trial, and I would encourage you to get the book and read it so that you can get exposed to all of that evidence. I summarize and hit on some of the key points in my movie so that you don't have to, but I recommend it. Anyhow, so you have established E. Howard Hunt as one of the assassins. In that book, Mark Lane does not say, well, actually, there's a sentence that can be, he says that all of the participants are dead, except George Bush. And I missed that sentence. I had to have somebody point it out to me. And he only says it once, and he says it in the middle of something else, and it's easily missed. He then brings up this memo that was written by J. Edgar Hoover 5 days after the assassination, in which the title of the memo is The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In the memo, he talks about what he calls misguided anti-Castro Cubans. E. Howard Hunt was the supervisor of these misguided anti-Castro Cubans. He was the supervisor of hundreds of them, perhaps thousands. He was certainly the supervisor of the small band, and he's well known as the supervisor of the small band of killers who broke into the Watergate Hotel. And Hunt later told the Washington Post that he was an assassin, that he supervised assassins. In any case, the Hoover memo goes on to tell things that are not true. It says that they investigated the Cuban community and they found... I have to start. In the first paragraph, it says that the State Department had asked the FBI to investigate the possibility that some of what Hoover calls misguided anti-Castro Cubans were planning to invade Cuba in response to the Kennedy assassination. There's a book that was published very recently by Fabian Escalante. He's the head of Cuban counterintelligence at the time. It's called JFK, The Cuba Files, and he reveals just page after page after page after page after page of evidence that, in fact, the CIA and their misguided Cubans were planning to invade Cuba after they killed John Kennedy. That's also the thrust of Escalante's book, is that these misguided Cubans, supervised by Hunt, had in fact killed John Kennedy. The reason that they were motivated to be involved is that they were promised that in return for killing Kennedy, they were going to get the opportunity to invade Cuba, kill Castro, and retake the island in the name of United Fruit and the Mafia. Anyhow, in the last paragraph of that essay, Hoover says that the FBI's false report on the fact that, in the second paragraph, Hoover says that he sent his agents to Miami to investigate whether the Cubans were in fact planning to do this, and he responds that they found that the Cuban community was distraught over the assassination. There were wild parties being thrown. They're mentioned in the Miami newspapers, the parties being thrown by the exile Cuban community in Miami. There can't be any question that Hoover also knew all of the details, that most of the details, certainly, that Escalante talks about of the planned CIA invasion of Cuba in response to the Kennedy assassination. If the State Department knew it, they learned of it from Hoover. But Hoover doesn't mention any of that. He totally discounts all of that stuff that we know that he knew. He discounts the partying being done by this Cuban exile community that we know that he knew, and he lies and says that they were in great sorrow. And then in the last paragraph, he says that this report was given to Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, I'm involved very timely in a large debate with this guy, Jim DeEugenio, who publishes a website called CTKA, and was one of the publishers of a very widely read book called The Assassins. Anyhow, he's a guy of great repute, and you hear intelligent people who I believe are honest and so on referring to him with great deference, and I think that he's an operative. He's certainly attacking the conclusions that I draw in a wildly unprofessional and in unintelligent fashion. And I mean, the guy has written extensively. He's very, very well versed. He's very knowledgeable, and nothing that I've ever seen that he's written has been incredibly stupid. But he says that this memo by Hoover doesn't indicate anything. He's not willing to consider what the title of the memo was. He's not willing. I say that if this report was given to Hoover, that indicates that Hoover was supervising these misguided anti-Castro Cubans, for whom there is a wealth of evidence demonstrating that they were involved in the assassination, so that it demonstrates that he was a supervisor of the assassin.
I'm sorry, you said Hoover, but you mean Bush?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Yes, the Hoover memo naming Bush as the person who received this report, I think demonstrates that Bush was the supervisor of the Cubans regarding whom this report was given. I have to admit, that was a terrible sentence, but so I've repeated it much more clearly, I think. I think also that, and let's take a moment to analyze that. If the FBI knows that the CIA is planning to invade Cuba, they are not going to be giving a report to a low-level individual. They're going to be giving this report to a person who's in a position to say, oh, I better go back and shut this down, right? The FBI knows that we're planning it. The State Department knows that we're planning it. I better go back and shut this down because we're busted. I'd rather expect that what they told Bush when he went to the FBI headquarters is, we know you killed the president, shut down the invasion, right? We're going to let you get away with the assassination of the president, shut down the invasion of Cuba. That is not going to happen. In fact, I could go on and on and on about it, but I think it's a rather minute point, and I'd rather go on. The fact that that report was given to George Bush, I think, demonstrates that George Bush is a very, very high-ranking member of the CIA in direct supervision of the killers. In addition to which, in my movie, you get all of this background that shows that Bush was not only in the CIA, beyond any shadow of a doubt, but that he was a prince. That is to say that he had all of these connections to the highest levels of the CIA. He did not join at the bottom. He joined at the top. His father, there's a lot of it in the movie. There's a lot of it that's not in the movie. His father was an enormously powerful and influential figure in the CIA, but he was not ostensibly in the CIA, although there's a letter that is, you see in the movie. One of Prescott is George Sr.'s father. Prescott and his friend Neil Mallon, who in a different letter Prescott identifies as a CIA recruiter, they call Alan Dulles to come meet with them. They don't go to meet with him. They call on him to come meet with them to discuss their pilot project in the Caribbean. George is their pilot project in the Caribbean. George is set up in the middle of the CIA operations in preparation for the Bay of Pigs. My point is that he was not a small-time member. He was brought in as a prince. He's the anointed child of an extremely high-ranking, extremely dark figure who was involved in the creation of the CIA and in all of these other very, very crucial matters regarding the CIA, and on and on and on, and I won't go on that point. The point is, that I'll then return to, is that I think the evidence demonstrating that Bush was a supervisor of the killers is overwhelming, but the fact that you're a supervisor of a team of killers does not mean that you supervise the killing, right? If they go out in the alley and grab some guy and kill him and rape his girlfriend, that doesn't mean that you supervised it. The fact that you were supervising them during daylight hours when they were trying to kill Fidel Castro or anybody else. However, there's a guy named Russ Baker who has written a book called Family of Secrets. And if you want to buy that book, you can do it for no other reason than the fact that in that book you will find a document that is just solid gold. He went to Dallas, to the Dallas Morning News, and he said, well, you know, I guess, you know, it takes the time to get there, but it didn't take longer to get there than it did to do the research. Then we have the Dallas Morning News for the day before and the day of and the day after the assassination. And in the Dallas Morning News for the day of the assassination, he finds an advertisement that Bush is speaking in Dallas that night. So we can place Bush in Dallas that night. That's not a small deal. His boys are in the street killing Kennedy the next day, and he is there that night. That's very, very powerful evidence that he was involved. In addition, you have another FBI memo that's also in the movie and really is the other crucial piece in putting the tail of this donkey on George Bush Sr., that is to say, proving that he was involved in the assassination. There's an FBI memo that says that the day of the assassination at 1:45, Bush made a phone call to and Mr. George Bush, and you know, they Mr. George Herbert Walker Bush, and they give his business address and on and on. I mean, it's a very, very, very incontrovertible identification. Made a phone call to us at 1:30 in the afternoon, and he wanted to let us know that one James Parrott had been speaking of killing the president. Now, and he tells the FBI that he is in Tyler, Texas, which is a 40-minute drive outside of Dallas, and he tells them that he's going to be back in Dallas that night. I think he's staying at the Sheraton. It doesn't matter. Maybe it's the Hilton, whatever. He tells them the hotel that he's staying in. So he's establishing that we just established he was there the night before. We established that he told the FBI he was going to be there the night of. And this phone call says that he was a 40-minute drive away. And for at least 10 years, I've been scratching my head till it was raw, saying, why the hell would he make this phone call? It's so incriminating. Fletcher Prouty was very much associated with all of these same individuals, right? He worked with the CIA on the Bay of Pigs, and he was a Pentagon liaison with the CIA. It would have been perfectly natural, given the demonstrable participation of the Pentagon in the Kennedy assassination. It would be perfectly logical to assume that Prouty was involved in the assassination, except that Prouty has for many years been writing articles that are wholly incriminating of an array of individuals, including, he's done really, really great work, first-rate stuff, about the CIA's participation in the Kennedy assassination. And the thing that he says, that the reason he began to be involved, he's in the movie JFK. He's Mr. X. Donald Sutherland in the movie JFK plays Fletcher Prouty. Oliver Stone says that if you buy the DVD and look at the features, there is one extensively on Fletcher Prouty being who I'm telling you that he is. Anyway, the reason that Prouty became interested in the Kennedy assassination in the first place is because the day of the assassination, he arrives in Australia from the South Pole. They sent him to the South Pole, and he picks up a paper in Australia, and he sees a picture of Oswald and this long article about Oswald's time in Russia and his ties to the Russians and to the Cubans and on and on. And he looks at his watch, and he looks at the time of the murder, and he calculates that Kennedy had been dead a few hours when this extensive article is published in Australia, and as a CIA operative, it struck him as a CIA, that this article was, to him, clearly a CIA operation, that it was clearly an article that had been planted by the agency.
Right, just to be clear, I believe that was the Christchurch Star out of New Zealand.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. I'm sure that you're correct. The point is, of that whole long diversion, and I apologize for it, is that Prouty was clearly an honest guy, right? He was trying to carry out Kennedy's orders to defang the CIA, right? He was writing the memos for Kennedy to take power away from the CIA and give it to any other agency, including the Army intelligence. He was also writing the memo, I believe he wrote 273, which was explaining Kennedy's plan to get out of Vietnam and to withdraw 1,000 soldiers before the end of the year, before Christmas. And they moved him out of the country because he was clearly a friend of John Kennedy. They moved him out of the country. They didn't move George Bush Sr. out of the country. They moved him into Dallas. So I think it's clear that if he's in Dallas, he's supervising his troops. To me, that's not a jump of the slightest amount. That's a very, very, very obvious and solid conclusion to draw from the fact that he's in Dallas. Now, unless you want to ask me a question, here's the question I'll ask, and you can pose a different one if you'd like to. Why the hell would he call the FBI and, right? If you're going to call the FBI, call them from New Zealand. Right? Don't call them from Tyler, Texas. And, right, why would he make that phone call? Let me say another couple of things. There is a new explanation for where Bush was. Bush has in the past said that he doesn't remember where he was on the day of the assassination. That in itself is extraordinarily, to anybody who was alive at the time of the Kennedy assassination, that is an extraordinarily incriminating remark, because everybody, I was in the sixth grade, and I could probably take you to the seat that I was sitting in, and I certainly can tell you the names of the teacher and the name of the vice principal who came through the door, and their remarks and their reactions and so on. and Bush doesn't remember any of it. Well, they have created an alibi for him that he was in Tyler, Texas, speaking to, I think, the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis. It doesn't matter. The claim is that he was there and that he was speaking, except that the news came over the radio that at 1:38, and certainly the people in the audience weren't listening to the radio as George Bush is up there speaking. And in fact, the guy who provides this alibi to Bush says that one of the, you know, that the head bellhop was listening to the radio, and that the head bellhop came up to him and said that the president had been assassinated, and that he then told somebody else, who then went up to Bush, who then announced it to the audience, and Bush then sat down. It doesn't say that Bush leaped up and ran to a phone and started making this phone call. Bush would have, all we know is that he sat down. Well, that's not the alibi. That's an alibi that's not going to wash, because he had to have got up and gone to a phone and dialed information and got the number for the FBI and called the FBI and got through the switchboard and got to the agent and made the report, and he had to do that within 7 minutes, right? All of that had to happen. Within, it had to go from mouth to mouth to mouth to Bush to phone to receptionist to FBI agent in 7 minutes. I don't find that a plausible scenario. I suppose it's possible, but it's just, given the fact that his witness doesn't say that he ran to a phone, but in fact that he sat down, given that, it's not in any by any means plausible scenario. But let's get back to the question of why the hell did he make the phone call? I mean, it's just, to me, it's just bizarre. It's so incriminating. And it was a few months ago that somebody sent me an email and told me to go to this website and read this statement. And I'm sure they gave me the selected quote from the statement, which I'll describe to you now. Roger Craig was Jim Garrison's favorite police officer, favorite detective in Dallas. And he's famous because he went to the book depository. He went here at the shops, he ran out onto the street, and he saw Oswald coming down from the grassy knoll and getting into a green Studebaker station wagon, which fits the description of Booth Payne's station wagon. And I won't go into that. If you know it, you know it. Otherwise, just let it go. He then went up to the book depository and witnessed the recovery of the rifle and stood there with one of his comrades and looked at the rifle and looked at the letters that said Mauser. It was not a Mannlicher Carcano. It was a Mauser. And he then went to the police chief Curry's office and walked in and saw Oswald sitting there and pointed to Oswald and said, "That's the guy I saw get into the station wagon," and he describes the station wagon. And on and on. I won't beat that one into the ground. He's a well-known guy. And he says that Jim Garrison was very interested to know. This is a 37-page article. In it, he says that Jim Garrison was very interested to know that who had been arrested that day. Garrison was persuaded that the killers had very likely been arrested. Garrison didn't think that police like Roger Craig were incompetent, that there were many other competent police officers, and he was rather certain that the killers were very likely rounded up, and he was interested to hear from the police officers the stories of the people who had been arrested that day. Garrison also, in Garrison's book, he says that there are stories about people being arrested, and there's a certain group of people who were arrested for whom there is no record, and there are other groups of people who were arrested for whom there are mugshots, fingerprints, and interviews. And Garrison says that he thinks the ones who have mugshots and fingerprints and interviews are plants, that they are CIA plants, and that they're there to cover up the real assassins, to provide cover for the real assassins. Anyhow, Roger Craig tells the story of all of the people who were arrested. And, right, he could have told the story of the tramps. He doesn't tell the story of the tramps. He tells the story of an individual who came running out of the Dow Techs building. Well, lots and lots of witnesses, everybody standing in front of the Dow Techs building, heard shooting fire from the lower floors of the Dow Techs building. And according to Roger Craig, this individual came running out, and he looked so guilty, and the crowd outside was so agitated and alerted by having heard the shots and heard the screams from farther down the street from the people who saw the president get murdered, that they grabbed this individual and they handed him over to the police. And the police officers on the scene then took him to police headquarters, but those police officers told Craig that this individual identified himself as an independent oil contractor from Houston. They took the individual to the police station where he was not photographed and he was not fingerprinted, and he was, as the crowd followed, and they waited for him outside the police station. And when this individual was escorted out of the police station and put into the back of a sheriff's car and driven off, they jeered at him. And he was driven off and never heard from again. In this phone call to the FBI, Bush identifies himself as an independent oil contractor from Houston.
Remarkable. So put the pieces together for us.
Bush got arrested coming out of the book depository. He was so freaked out by the fact that he had been arrested coming out of the book depository. He was so scared that that information was going to come out. He was so afraid that somebody in the crowd was going to later recognize him, that he, because he was the chairman of the Texas Republican Party, right? It's plausible that there would have been somebody in there who would have looked, seen him and said, hey, that's the chairman of the Texas Republican Party, that he was anxious to establish an alibi for himself, even if it only put him 40 miles out of town. To him, being 40 miles out of town was a good alibi. I mean, to me, there's no other explanation I can find plausible. Being 40 miles out of town is not a good alibi when it's come out that you are a high-level supervisor of the CIA's assassination hitmen, right? I mean, there's all this other evidence tying Bush to Hunt in any case, right? That Bush was Hunt's supervisor, and you have Hunt being involved, and if we can establish that your supervisor was not sent out of the country but was in fact 40 miles away in Tyler, Texas, that does not let you off the hook by any means. In fact, it's enormously incriminating. But if you had been arrested on the sidewalk coming out of with gunpowder on your hands or certainly on your clothing because you're standing next to the shooters, I don't mean to suggest that there's no evidence that I know of to suggest that Bush was a marksman. Hunt was a trained, he was a sniper trainer. He was a sniper instructor. And Bush was his supervisor. Did I do that? Did I tie your pieces together?
I think you did. I must admit that has always been just a remarkably baffling document to me, and I couldn't for the life of me imagine why he would want to place himself in that mix, but that certainly would be a good reason, certainly, if he was arrested, which I've actually never even heard that before. That's remarkable.
Oh, no, that's brand new. That's brand spanking new. There's a discussion of it on JFK Murder Solved. Which is where I originally, all praise and glory to Vim Dankbar, who is the founder of the site and who posted the memo from the FBI saying that Mr. George Bush, an independent oil contractor from Houston, I think they name his independent oil company. So they do, I'm sure. They name it Zapata Offshore Oil from Houston, Texas. Now, let me polish that just a little bit more, bring it back to something else that I said. And let me introduce it a little bit. E. Howard Hunt has been, people have said that E. Howard Hunt was one of the tramps. And I don't know if you've seen the pictures of Che Guevara when he was going to Bolivia, but if you see those pictures, he's a balding, middle-aged businessman and fat. And you see the pictures, and that's what he is. I mean, it's just a fabulous costume that he has on. I don't think that you would ever guess that it was Che Guevara unless somebody told you, and then you look at it and you say, okay, maybe, all right. E. Howard Hunt, people want to say that he's a tramp, and I've looked at the pictures, and I have on, I have it sitting around. I don't see it handy. There's a book, right, that written extensively and has transparencies that invite you to draw that conclusion, Coup d'etat in America, I believe it's called. And I looked at all of that stuff, and I didn't find it, I found it plausible, right? I thought that they made the case that, yes, this indeed very well could be Hunt, I didn't find it persuasive. What I find persuasive is that Hunt's son looked at those pictures and instantly, gut reaction, did a double take and said, oh my God, that's my father. That I find persuasive. I don't think that you could, you know, you can't ask for more powerful eyewitness identification of a photograph, I think, than the individual's son. Anyhow, the point is that on the same website, JFK Murders Solved, you also see pictures of Hunt wearing the exact, you see Hunt wearing the exact same costume, and he's not on behind the grassy knoll, he's in front of the grassy knoll. He's with the crowd of people who are moving towards the grassy knoll, and he's wearing exactly the same costume that he wore when he went to the Watergate hearings. Right, he had to testify during the Watergate hearings, and tie all those pieces together. He's going to wear the same costume to the Kennedy assassination that he wears to the Watergate hearings. What sense does that make? Well, the sense that I draw from it is that Hunt has a double, right? That Hunt was on the grassy knoll, that he was in the railroad yard. He got arrested in the railroad yard. He is in the photographs of the tramps, but that he had somebody wear his costume and stand where he would certainly positively get photographed by somebody that day in order to establish the story that he tells on his deathbed. Oh, yes, they invited me, and I said no. But, you know, if anybody had shown that photograph, he would have said, he'd either claim it wasn't him or he would, you know, hard enough pressed. If there had been better evidence produced that he was, in fact, the tramp, he would say, no, look at this photograph. It's not me. So that he had a CIA double on the scene, as Garrison suggested that the real killers did. Bush had a double on the scene, which is a guy named Jim Brading, who was arrested. And the arresting officer commented that this guy seemed like he was trying to get arrested, who was an independent oil contractor from Los Angeles, who got arrested coming out of the Dow Tech building, and as I said, deliberately got himself arrested coming out of the Dow Tech building. I think I'm done.
And of course, there seem to be multiple Oswalds on the scene as well, so certainly I think this would be pretty standard operating procedures for a lot of the intelligence operations that were running around this massive intelligence operation. So what's your take on the E. Howard Hunt confession?
That it's a lie, that he tells you stuff that you can find 40 other places that's true about the involvement of Sturgis and so on. He names a few other people. But then he points the finger at Johnson and a guy named McCord. No, that's Cord.
Frank McCord?
No, if you're very, very familiar, since you asked the question, I'd be counting on you to be very familiar with the Hunt confession. I've read it a couple of times, and, you know, I was grossed out at how ridiculously stupid it was. This is a guy who worked hand-in-hand with George Bush, and he doesn't name Bush. So, you know, it's obviously a cover. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, it's very, 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 very difficult to prove the innocence of Lyndon Johnson, right? I mean, he's so next to everything. I haven't ever found anything that was remotely definitive in proving Johnson's innocence. I'll talk about that in a second. But the fact that Hunt names Johnson says to me that Johnson was innocent, although I guess you could apply the same reasoning to Sturgis. But I think he names Sturgis in order to give himself credibility, and he names Johnson in order to point people away from Bush and that wing of the power elite. That is ask me the question, who killed Kennedy? I was at a convention in Dallas. Was it the day of the assassination? It might have been. And it was so bizarre. There was a Republican women's group having an affair in the same hotel, and it was in the evening. And we were we'd done all our workshops during the day, and we were going to watch some movie that, and I don't know what else. Anyhow, I was helping to man the table, and this Republican woman comes up, and she was very, very feisty and very bright, and it seemed to me a little bit drunk. But, and maybe I only say that based on how forthcoming and free-lipped she was. And she says, so who killed him? And I was taken aback because I didn't expect this from a Republican woman. And, I wasn't expecting, the thing had been going on at least all day, and it might have been going on for 2 days. So I didn't expect some, person from outside the loop to come walking up and ask a question like that. We'd been discussing that question, but how do you explain the answer? And she says, who killed him? The CFR? And I looked at the guy sitting at the table. I said, in three letters, you can't give a better answer to that question, right? The Council on Foreign Relations, which is dominated by the Rockefellers, but includes all of the leading lights of the Eastern establishment. And, it's not dominated by the oil people, the Texas oil people. That is not who it is dominated by. It's dominated by the Eastern oil people. I forget what question I'm answering.
We were on the topic of Hunt's confession and how he was perhaps things towards LBJ.
Right. So Hunt does not point to the Council on Foreign Relations. He points to Johnson. Oh, right. There, Madeleine Brown, right, is the other. Are you familiar with Madeleine Brown, yes?
I want to say yes, but at the moment it's slipping my mind.
She's I want to call her a prostitute. She's on the History Channel. And
LBJ's mistress.
It's so-called, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right. I'm sorry. LBJ's mistress. And I don't mean to say that she's a liar. But if you listen to her story, she talks about how she got invited to all of these Texas millionaire parties. Well, why do you think they keep inviting her? Because she's such a brilliant conversationalist. Okay. All right. Okay. I'll accept that answer. But let's just move along because it's not the point. She says she's there with Johnson. And that Johnson comes walking out of a meeting with these guys. And I can never remember the name of this individual. But she comes walking out of a meeting, at least one of whom is CFR. He's the CFR guy who was on the Warren Commission. He's a Rockefeller thug who was on the Warren Commission. And I've looked his name up 20 times, and I can never make it stick to the tip of my tongue. Anyhow, Johnson comes walking out of that meeting and walks up to her and says loudly, well, I won't have to have those Kennedys, won't be a thorn in my side anymore after today. And I'm totally open to the notion that Johnson was told at that meeting that Kennedy was going to be murdered. And that if he had any goddamn brains at all, he was going to keep his mouth shut and cooperate. And at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, while he's on Air Force One the next day, Johnson gets a call from McGeorge Bundy, who is not only Skull and Bones, he's just, he's CFR and CIA as deeply as you can get, right? And like Prescott and George Sr., he's a prince. Right, he is not one of the low-level guys. He is so upper echelon that he's not even in the CIA. Right, he's responsible for making sure Ford Foundation money gets to the CIA. He doesn't go in there and punch a time card. He calls up whoever the head of the CIA is that week and tells them to come and meet with him. Anyhow, or he just bypasses that individual completely and has his conversations with whoever's the head of operations, or bypasses that individual and has his conversations with the people who are going to be involved in the operation, directly involved in supervising the operation. Bundy calls Johnson at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and tells him it's a lone assassin, we've got the guy, it's Lee Harvey Oswald, no conspiracy. Now, at 11 o'clock that night, the Dallas DA is saying that it's a conspiracy and they're going to get these guys in the electric chair is too good for them. He doesn't say the electric chair is too good for him. How the hell is George Bundy able to call the president from the Situation Room and give him that explanation? Well, he's a very, 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 very high-ranking individual, and he's giving Johnson his orders. And the orders, in fact, that he's giving Johnson is that we're not invading Cuba. We're invading Vietnam. The mafia and the CIA, the Cubans who were on the street in Dallas and pulling the triggers and fleeing the scene, were promised that there was going to be an invasion of Cuba. Well, those chumps got took. There's going to be an invasion of Vietnam, and there is not going to be an invasion of Cuba. I'm done.
All right. Well, it's very interesting because I have looked at the Hunt Confession for the last few years, and it is difficult to know what to make of it, but it certainly does seem to gesture towards LBJ, which I think most people who have researched the assassination would say is either a red herring, or I guess the possibility is that Hunt didn't know how far up the establishment this actually went. But I think that's unlikely because, as you say, he was likely being supervised by people like George Bush. So definitely it seems to be.
He was supervised by Bush all of his life. I'm leaving something out. Oh, here's one that you're familiar with Fletcher Prouty, yes?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And this is something, you know, as long as we're sharing gems as far as I'm concerned. But I'm not trying to get down into the nitty-gritty of detail such as to hit on the things that I'm a little bit proud of having discovered. In Plausible Denial, right, Mark Lane's book, he quotes Fletcher Prouty extensively about these ships, right? And in my movie, I quoted, and I got attacked by this guy, De Eugenio, for saying this. And I responded, you didn't attack Mark Lane when he said it, and you certainly never attacked Fletcher Prouty for saying it, because if you had, people would have looked at you and said, this guy's an op. Anyhow, but he attacked me for saying it because he can, and because I've made a movie in which I don't suggest that Bush was a director of the assassination. I say so as clearly and as loudly and as often as I can. Anyhow, Prouty says in his book, and he tells Mark Lane, and Mark Lane repeats it, that George Bush, during World War II, had a plane, and he named it the Barbara, and it got shot down, and he named his next plane the Barbara, and he then takes that and ties it to the fact that one of the ships at the Bay of Pigs was purchased by the military and recommissioned and repainted and to be disguised to look as a civilian ship and was renamed the Barbara J. And Prouty ties those two facts together. And he also ties together the extremely little-known fact that Bush's oil company was called Zapata Oil, and that the code name for the Bay of Pigs invasion was Operation Zapata. The name of the ship at the Bay of Pigs has to be known by less than 1/1,000 of 1% of the population, 1/1,000,000 of 1% of the population, I think I'm willing to say, certainly less than 1/10,000 of 1% of the population, and less than 1/10 of 1% of the people who consider themselves scholars on the subject of Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs and whatnot. I'm just astonished at the ignorance of people on that particular topic. You can ask me why in a minute. The point is that I don't find it particularly plausible. I ask the question, as I do any time I find people making a connection like that, how the hell would you come to link those two facts? You can't possibly have run into them one right after the other. They're so disparately, they're so widely dispersed, one between the other. How could you possibly have linked them? And I don't doubt that I thought about that, I don't know how many years, but certainly 10. And it occurred to me recently that Fletcher Prouty's job was to provide the military hardware to the CIA for their operations. He was the guy who Bush gave the order. Bush made the request to Prouty. Absolutely. I don't think there's a question about this. That if Prouty is correct, that the boat was renamed at Bush's request, if Bush made the request for the renaming, there's no question but that he made it to Prouty because it was Prouty's job to supply the CIA with that ship and on all of the other vast amounts of military material that they had for the invasion. But Prouty couldn't say that because it was classified. The fact that Bush was in the CIA was classified. The fact that Bush was involved with the Bay of Pigs is classified. Prouty couldn't say that. But the fact that Bush had named his planes after his wife, well, Prouty knew that because Bush told him. And he told him that he wanted to rename the boat after his wife, the same way he had named his planes. But the naming of the planes was public. It was in Bush's autobiography, as Prouty bothered to find out before he said it. And the naming of the boat was, you know, public information. That is to say, the name of the boat was public information. It had been published, although it had been published in a not very widely known resource. If you have a question, I'll answer it. Otherwise, I'll go on and ask that question. Why do I say that the people who are supposed to know about the Bay of Pigs are so incredibly ignorant? I'm just going to roll on.
Please answer that. Yeah.
I read a book that was probably Prouty that referred me to VR Rifle. And I read a book called VR Rifle, which referred me to the first book that Fabian Escalante, the head of Cuban counterintelligence, wrote. And I read that book, and in that book, there's a footnote. And all of these were footnotes, right? I mean, I got the reference from Prouty's footnote to VR Rifle, and I got the reference from the VR Rifle footnote to Escalante, and I got the reference from Escalante's footnote to a government publication. There is one copy in the city of Los Angeles. I shouldn't say that because the CIA people listening will run out and burn it. I guess I won't say where it's at, but anyhow. You can buy it for $140 at Amazon, I think, or anyway. It's called Operation Zapata. And in it, you have to give it a close and slow read, and you have to underline relevant parts, and you have to go back and read those relevant parts over and over and over. And when you do, I hope that it will become clear to you that the CIA went to Kennedy with the plan to invade Cuba, and Kennedy said, oh, hell no. No freaking way. If you want to smuggle some guerrillas in the middle of the night, fine, but no, the exact words, no D-Day style operations. And then, I don't know how many months later, a couple, maybe 3 months later, the CIA launches a D-Day style operation. And it may be that they went to Kennedy and got Kennedy to approve a guerrilla operation to smuggle some guerrillas in the middle of the night, but they certainly never went to Kennedy and got approval for the invasion that they carried out.
Right, and it is bizarre not bizarre, I suppose, it just shows the true colors, but there are so many gatekeepers on the left who will vehemently deny the idea that JFK was actually planning to withdraw from Vietnam, and that he was that he did disapprove of the Bay of Pigs and all these other things that people will deny in order to make it less likely that his death was an assassination.
Right.
I'm sorry, that his assassination was committed by the elements of the U.S. apparatus.
I don't know what to think again about Chomsky, but it does sound like he plays a role. There are explanations, right? If he's a hardcore Marxist, if you think that you're a hardcore Marxist, but in fact you're just a stupid ape, you could say, oh, well, the ruling class is monolithic, and they would never kill one of their own. Well, Marx never said anything like that. And in fact, Marx describes the conspiracies involved in the French government that led to the Paris Commune. But, you know, if there's any hardcore Marxists in your audience, they'll appreciate the notion that Marx writes that, and whether you're Marxist or not, Marx writes that the Franco-Prussian War was started by a conspiracy. And you get the flavor of that in the history books. The history books will all say that the Franco-Prussian War was started on a pretext, right? That that somebody insulted somebody, and they start a war based on an insult between two individuals. And that's what they put in front of the public, is, oh, we have to go to war because this guy insulted this other guy. And Marx says, no, they wanted to end democracy in France. They couldn't get the French army to fire on the people of Paris, so they started a war with the Germans to get the German army to fire on the democratic revolution, the communards, the leaders of the communards, the leaders of the democratic revolution in Paris. In getting people to be anti-communist, I believe that they're getting people to be anti, they're moving people against the people who founded the modern democratic movement. Anyway, which I see as the French, right? And the Americans, I don't consider the American Revolution a democratic revolution. It didn't include women, it didn't include slaves, and it didn't include Indians, and it didn't include 90% of the white population.
Agreed. Well, certainly, and I think the rhetoric of the American Revolution was brilliant, but the implementation was not. So, absolutely.
Well, it was a bill of goods, right? The guys who started it and were planning to benefit from it, and I don't mean to take us down a rabbit hole, but it's worth saying, and I think it's important. The guys who started the revolution were slave owners and slave traders and smugglers, and they wanted to separate from the king. And they didn't want to fight the war, but they needed to separate from the king. And they needed to mobilize the nation. They needed to mobilize the farmers. They needed to mobilize some freaking buddy to go out there and carry a gun and stand up in front of the British army, which was, you know, not unskilled, unarmed, and untrained. Somebody had to go out there and face those bullets. Well, it ain't going to be us. How are we going to get these country chumps to go out and do our dirty work for us? Well, listen to this. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal and are endowed by their... It sounds... Hey, man, that's hot. Publish that. That's what we're fighting for? Yeah, we're not fighting for the rights... Oh, man. We're not fighting for the rights of Washington and the rest of these guys to slaughter Native Americans and steal their land, which the king had objected to vehemently. The king said, I signed those treaties with the Indians. Get your stinking hands off of them. Those are my subjects that you are slaughtering, and you're stealing the land that I gave them. Stop it. And that, right, so it was the people who had their eyes on stealing more Native American land, and the people who were slave owners, the king was also moving towards banning slavery, that were the instigators of that revolution. Anyway.
Right. Well, just to backtrack a little bit, I believe Chomsky would identify himself as an anarcho-syndicalist rather than a Marxist. But the point is well taken that that it really can't be seen as other than gatekeeping for the way that he vehemently and consistently denies the JFK assassination conspiracy theories, as they're termed.
Well, and how did he deny 9/11?
By saying that, who cares, is a direct quote, I believe. But yeah,
well, no,
yeah,
said,
no, it's remarkable.
Said, they'd have to be insane to do that. I've heard him say, oh, they'd have to be insane to do that. Yeah, and that's an argument against them doing it. Okay, all right.
Yeah, exactly, right. Well, yes, I think my listeners will be well situated to parse that. But let's move on to something that you've talked about a couple of times now, and I think is important to touch on, because you have mentioned the CTKA hit piece on your work. And I guess it certainly is quite important, obviously, because you've talked about Delgenio's reputation. And I guess my question is, will you have a sort of formal response to this on your website, or will there be something that you're going to do to counteract that, or how are you going to deal with this?
The way I've been dealing with it is to address it where it's raised and to ignore it where it's not. And I haven't raised it on my website because I don't think that the 99% of the population are familiar. And God, I mean, have you read it?
Yes, and I actually have, yeah.
Yes, well, congrats. You know, what is it, 25 pages?
Yeah, it's quite voluminous.
And it's horrible, I think. I mean, you know, I find it impenetrable, and it's... Anyway, I have raised, you can find my rebuttals at JFK Murder Solved, because they raised it at JFK Murder Solved. And so, and you know, I asked the Eugenio, are you going to allow me to respond? And he said, no. Okay, all right. Well, so now what? And anyway, to me, it's just such a stupid, ugly rabbit hole that I don't bring it up at my site. I do have a link that I can send you if you like, where I have Coogan's statement, my response, the Eugenio's response, and my response. They're all at JFK Murder Solved. I have them on a hidden page at my website, but I don't put them out front because I don't think that it's really that much of a problem. Right? I mean, I didn't make my movie for those people, what percent of the population, I don't know. The small percent of the population that read 25-page hit pieces on a little-known documentary about Bush's involvement. I tried to make it. I wanted it to be something that would be able to be absorbed massively, and you know, which makes it, on the one hand, that's one of the things that makes it easy for the Eugenio to attack, because I sometimes speak in broad statements rather than giving the last detail of nuance into everything. Right? When I talk about the boats, I don't call the boat at the Bay of Pigs the Barbara J. I call it the Barbara. And in one of the responses that I've been forced into, J in Latin is II. And Bush, being a classic devil worshiper, if you'll allow me to go there, you know what I'm saying, that these guys are into that sort of... His Skull and Bones name, I believe, is Beelzebub, but they're into that sort of weird crap. And so I think that it's legitimate to suggest that it is called the Barber too, because J in Latin is double I. But I'm not going to go into all of that in a movie that I want people to sit down and watch in one sitting. And so I just left the J off altogether. And God, you know, that's a horrible distortion. Well, no, it isn't either. And in any case, you know, Prouty said it from firsthand knowledge, but he puts it in this codified fashion. You brought it up. The one error that I made in the movie that I'll cop to is that I said that the CIA killed our Benz, and I had always thought that the CIA killed our Benz. They bombed the palace, right? I think that they intended to kill our Benz, or maybe they were satisfied to run him out of the country. I said that they killed him. I thought that they had killed him. It turns out that they didn't. And they didn't kill Mossadegh. It took him a couple of weeks. He died in CIA custody, but he didn't die immediately. Well, Lumumba died in CIA custody. He didn't die immediately either, but perhaps they didn't shoot Mossadegh. I don't know what it is.
Which is fairly peripheral to the subject of the JFK assassination, so I think...
And certainly not. I mean, you know, if D. Eugenio wanted to write me, I want to say a polite letter, whatever, you know, write me a rude letter if that's your choice, criticizing one thing and another. Oh, you know, he calls me, he may call me an idiot. He says it's ridiculous. I would suggest that Kennedy had not approved the Bay of Pigs invasion. Well, I'm sorry, you know, do your freaking homework. I believe I've posted the pages from, they're posted in one of the versions of my movie. They're not in the latest version. I believe they're at my website. The pages from the book that indicate that Kennedy had not, that in fact, right, it says, he said no D-Day style invasion, and then they turned around and did that. The main thing in that attack is saying that I said things that I didn't say and then attacking those. Although the one legitimate one is that I said that Arbenz was murdered, and it turns out he was only overthrown. He was not murdered. There was something else I wanted to say about it, but go ahead.
All right. Well, I think we can leave it there for now. I think that's a reasonable response, and probably the best way to deal with such an attack anyway. So we are running towards the end of the time that I have today to talk to you, and we could talk about this for hours and hours. And I certainly hope that you will come on again at a later date, and maybe we can talk about the JFK Jr. Film, which I think is equally important and extremely interesting. But I guess just to wrap up this conversation, I'd like to find out what you might be working on now and what you might be working on next.
There's a couple of things I want to do. One and I'm teaching, right? And I teach full time. I mean, I teach overtime in Los Angeles in an inner city school. And, you know, my kids are troubled, and I take all of my energy, and it's very, 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 very difficult to get the energy after I come home to pick this stuff up. But having said that, I wanted to put together a quick piece attacking, if Leonardo DiCaprio is going to rely on the people, you know, did you run into that DiCaprio's has announced that he's making a movie for the 50th anniversary on the Kennedy assassination?
I did not hear that. I shudder to think.
And, well, I don't. I mean, I haven't. I really like Titanic. You know, I thought it had a lot of things to recommend it. I liked a movie called 11th Hour on global warming that I thought was very, very good. I would have liked it to be better, but I'm not going to nitpick. Anyhow, he's relying on these people who blame it on the mafia. And, you know, Garrison nailed it 40 years ago that the mafia did not steal the body and they didn't alter the wounds and they didn't put it back and they didn't then tell the autopsy doctor to burn his notes and not to probe the throat wound and not to probe the back wound. And they didn't tell the New York Times to lie, and they didn't tell every newspaper in the country to lie, and they didn't change the parade route, and on and on and on, right? All of these things that the mafia was no freaking way in a position to do. You know, the mafia didn't tell the, if the mafia did it, what's Johnson's motivation for the Warren Commission?
Right.
And so I wanted to make a piece like that I wanted to make it short and simple and clear and accessible so that it might have a chance of becoming viral and getting, you know, many, many thousands of hits, if not a couple of million. I also wanted to, and I'm sorry I didn't do this at the top of the interview, suggest that people watch Oliver Stone's latest movie, South of the Border. There are parts of that movie that just creep me out. He tries to encourage it's just so slimy, where he tries to get the president of Bolivia to do cocaine with him. But there are parts of that movie that are just monstrously important. He interviews the president of Argentina. The president of Argentina was in exactly the position that the president of Ireland is in, that the president of Spain is in, that the president of Greece is in, and that this president of Portugal is in, which is that they had this debt and they had the world, the IMF and the World Bank trying to shove these enormously cruel and ineffective, I mean destructive, not economy building programs, but economy destroying programs, trying to shove those on to the backs of the Argentine people. And Kirchner stood up to them. And Bush came down and was trying to push the same stuff. And in a face-to-face encounter, Kirchner stood up to Bush and said, hell no, we're not doing that. He tells Stone that he kept the chair that he was sitting in when he said it to Bush. And he tells Stone that he replied to Kirchner, tell Stone that he replied to Bush, what the U.S. needs to do in South America, they did in Europe after World War II, than imposing all of these onerous loans upon us, and rather than imposing all of these destructive so-called, what are we going to call it? economic measures, improvements, reforms, that in fact destroy the economy, put a stranglehold on the economy, you should implement the Marshall Plan and, you know, give us a big leg up, give us a help us get our economies on our feet without demanding all of this, you know, this onerous burden to be borne. And he says that Bush exploded and talking about what a terrible program the Marshall Plan had been and how this was a really terrible idea of the Democrats, and that pause for a dramatic effect. The only thing that has ever improved, that has ever built the economy of the United States is war. When debating what the reasoning of the perpetrators of 9/11 was for accomplishing 9/11, I think that it wasn't oil so much as it was that one, that they wanted to. Clinton had been cutting the defense budget in very significant ways. It's this year, it's over $700 billion on paper. And I'm sure that it's much, 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 much more than that off the books, you know, including the care that has to go on for all of the injured veterans and their families. The last thing is that Stone asks Kirchner whether none of the bankers, he says, didn't any of the bankers ever lean into you and say, you know what the implications of this are? And Kirchner replies, siempre, always. And what the hell does that mean? And, I mean, I've been stewing on this rather constantly for the last couple of months, and I can't come up with an answer other than Stone is asking him, didn't they lean into you and say, we're going to need you for doing this? I, who personally are not going to get out of this unscathed. And then, about 3 weeks ago, just as they're really putting the screws to the Irish and the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Greeks, and just as people in Ireland and Spain and Portugal and Greece are calling on their governments to follow Kirchner's example, at 60 years old, Kirchner suddenly drops dead from a heart attack. And in my movie, and that's a reason to get it, you get to see William Colby explained to the senators, hold up a gun that shoots an ice dart that gives you a heart attack and is completely undetectable. And I think they killed Kirchner. I think that's the most plausible. I mean, there's just too many pieces that come together exactly, precisely correct to suggest it's more likely that he really died of a heart attack.
Quite startling, but it certainly would not be surprising. So will you be doing some work on that, maybe writing an essay or something?
Yeah, no. No, but I have March and April off, and I will certainly get it done in March and April. I have 2 weeks off at Christmas. I might succeed in getting it done in March and April. Other than that, I've talked to you, you know, and I've said it to a couple of people every once in a while. I send somebody an email outlining it briefly. Other than that, I think I'm going to, I have some other ideas, but I think I'm just going to bite my tongue rather than put it into the ear of somebody who says, oh, no, we can't have that happen. You know, on the other hand, I've made the worst movie I could think of to make, right? I made the most inflammatory and blunt and bold movie that I could think of to make. And, you know, I also went out immediately. Yeah, I got a wife and two kids. I went out immediately and got the largest life insurance policy that I could afford. It's about to expire, but that's okay because they're going to be able to get my retirement if I die. So I'm no longer so worried about my dependents as I used to be, but I, you know, Gary Webb. Do you know Gary Webb?
The author of Dark Alliance, who supposedly committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the head.
Thank you. And Lisa Pease, who is Jim DeEugenio's closest associate, called me up screaming at me because I was trying to get the family to get an autopsy. And in fact, I had gotten the family, I had their signatures, agreeing to let me take the body from the mortuary where it was and ship it to Cyril Wecht, of all people, who would agree to do the autopsy for half his price. He said of, you know, the 23,000 or so autopsies he'd done, he'd never seen a two-shot to the head suicide. Anyway, Lisa Pease is DeEugenio's best friend. You know, let DeEugenio publish me on Gary Webb. It will never happen. I mean, everybody in your audience, write to DeEugenio and say, hey, why don't you publish Hanky on Gary Webb, just to expose him. I have a photograph of which I, if you have a website.
Yes, I do.
I should send it to you, and you should post it so that I don't have to worry that I'm going to get killed lest I release this photograph. It's not been widely circulated. Of Gary Webb, taken by, I hired a private investigator, right? I'm on a teacher's salary, which is to say I'm church mouse poor. But I paid this guy $300 to get the family, to contact the family and get their signature on it and giving me permission. And this guy not only got their permission for me to do the autopsy, he got their permission to walk in and examine the body and take photographs. And it appears, he says, that he was shot twice in the ear canal, and there's a photograph that shows what appear to be two exit wounds on his left cheek. Mike Rupert, I don't know if you're familiar with Mike Rupert.
Yes, from the wilderness.
Yeah, he attacked, just viciously attacked me. And first he claimed that Gary shot himself with a shotgun. And then he says on his website, it's there today, that he shot himself in the head and it blew out his lower jaw, and then he shot himself again. He's just making this stuff up.
So you have a photograph then?
Yes, and I have to tell you that I sent it to his bed buddy, I want to say. But anyway, somebody who's obviously way too close a friend, I sent him this photograph. But a very, very intelligent guy. And he looks at it and says, oh, yeah, the jaw's been put back. And, you know, I told him. I called my investigator and told him, this guy says the jaw has been put back. And he says, I handled his jaw. It didn't come off of my hand. You know, I handled his head extensively. His jaw did not come off of my hand. His jaw was not blown off by anything. His jaw was completely intact. But there's a hair. There is a hair. One of Gary's hairs is on his jaw. You can't see that. But, I mean, you know, he's not a porcelain doll. And if he were a porcelain doll, it might be a hair crack. But it's certainly not a ragged edge of any means. Anyhow, Gary Webb was murdered. Oh, God, it's sick. Nobody, all these people, Robert Perry, I don't know what you think about Robert Perry, but name another guy on the left who you might think that you could trust. It doesn't matter. There's no newsman in the country who has written about Gary Webb being murdered. It was written about it, about him being shooting himself in the head twice. And I think it was Perry, and I don't remember vividly. ConsortiumNews.com, and I don't know if it's Perry who does Consortium News or somebody else. It's somebody very much like Perry. And he wrote a thing about Gary Webb saying, oh, this is so terrible. And he was so betrayed by his colleagues in the industry who failed to come to his defense when he was being attacked. And I wrote back and said, what about his colleagues who failed to acknowledge that he shot him in the head twice? And this guy, whoever it was, wrote back to me and said, oh, but there was an autopsy. And I wrote back and he did shoot himself in the head twice. And I wrote back and said, no, there wasn't either. And here's the photograph that shows you that the body was not dissected and that, you know, that there was no autopsy, and he didn't write back. And I'd come to discover that Lisa Pease works for him, and I rather suspect Lisa Pease answers his emails, and that whoever it is that I'm impugning his good name, when in fact it was Lisa Pease who said those things and who is blocking cut off the conversation when whoever this person was received the photograph.
Very, very interesting. Well, certainly if you send that picture along, I will post that in the documentation section for this interview. So those who are of greater intestinal fortitude than perhaps myself can examine in greater detail.
Oh, it's not that horrible a photograph. I mean, it is a dead guy. I want you to post it so that I'm not the only guy on the planet who has it.
Of course, right.
I guess I should have it posted on my website, come to think of it. But anyway, if you could possibly send me an email.
Absolutely. I certainly will. Excellent. Well, I forget how we got on the subject of Gary Webb. Oh, yes, yourself and your own situation.
Oh, right. Yeah, no kidding. What I'm thinking about doing in the future and how comfortably I sleep at night.
Well, it certainly is a serious matter.
Oh, well, let me, as long as we're still talking, the Holocaust. There's a book called Perfidy that shows the involvement of the Rothschilds in the perpetration of the Holocaust. There's an article that was published in 1942 in the New York Times called I Was Hitler's Boss. I think if you Google it, it'll turn up. If you take those two pieces of information and put them together, and if you ask me, if you're that interested, I'll send you the 26-page scholarly article I wrote on it in a hurry. The Holocaust was, and World War II, were perpetrations of the bankers. They wanted to destroy the Soviet Union. They recognized, I think accurately, that notion that you should have a society that was not run by billionaires. I mean, capitalism means rule by the billionaires. That's what it means. If you suggest it means something else, you're being dishonest. And they recognized the Soviet Union as a threat to the notion of rule by the billionaires, not to mention that the Soviet Union gave women the right to vote, and therefore the U.S. had to give women the right to vote. But anyhow, that's the purpose of creating Hitler, which they did, that the article from the New York Times demonstrates that they did. He was utterly a creation of the banks. The Holocaust was a creation of the banks, and the only way that they were able to force it upon the Germans, the German military, and I want to say Goering, the guy who was the head of the Luftwaffe, the guy who was the head of the economy, just a brilliant individual, who got thrown out of high school for defending Jews, and on and on and on. None of the German leaders in their youth and by their young, very much adulthood, none of them were anti-Semitic, including Hitler. But this was forced upon them because the bankers recognized, as a result of the Turkish genocide, during the Turkish genocide, New York Life made millions of dollars off of the dead Armenians, and the Sultan of Armenia demanded that New York Life give them the money, and New York Life said, screw you, Charlie. But the Sultan had been told by New York Life agents in his palace, if you kill all the Armenians, you'll be able to get their money. Right, they've all deposited their money with New York Life, and you'll be able to get it if you kill them all. If you kill all the descendants down to the last one, then there's nobody to receive the money. They have to give it to you. They told him that. He went out and killed them. And so then they thought, oh, Jesus, let's do this in Europe with the Jews. Think of all the... They made a trillion, $1945, the bankers. Right? Chase Manhattan Bank seized the assets of its Jewish depositors in Paris before Hitler told them to do so, and then ordered Hitler to order them to do it. They never turned over the assets of their Jewish depositors. The Nazis are prying gold out of the teeth of corpses, and they're not getting the gold out of the banks. What sense does that make? Because they were taking orders from the bankers.
Well, I don't think that's a conclusion that many of my listeners would be willing to dispute, because certainly we know, we certainly know the Union Banking Corporation and their role in funding the Nazi regime.
Sure, right? Oh, yeah.
Such connections, right?
There are a million pieces that this fits very neatly,
yeah.
Right? There was an article a couple of weeks ago, this week. You probably saw it. It was in the front section of the L.A. Times. And I think I even saw it I saw it somewhere else. About the CIA protecting Nazis, hiding Holocaust participants.
That's right. Yes, it was in the New York Times as well.
Right.
And of course that's a very, very old story, but it's important that it's now finally being reported in the Times.
It's a piece of this whole. It's
yes.
A piece that you can explain with this explanation. You can fit all the pieces. Right. This is a paradigm.
Alan Dulles was one of the key people involved in Operation Paperclip and bringing the people over. And
Alan Dulles was
involved.
Supervising the Holocaust. The reason he went to Switzerland was to supervise the Holocaust. And he was in direct communication with all of the leaders of the Holocaust, promising them, oh, listen, don't sweat it. You got my promise. We're getting you out. And making sure that they did it. But listen, I got to go and you got to go. And
yes,
but if you have
absolutely.
Me back on, you have your list of questions, and we'll go into anything you want.
Well, I'd be happy to do that again, and I'd like to thank you again for all the time you took today. So once again, let's just tell people how they can actually get copies of your documentaries if they haven't yet done so.
It will it's at Amazon in Japan. If you're going to order it, I would prefer that you order it from Amazon as JFK2, JFKII. If you order it as JFKII, I get the money and not my thieving agent.
Excellent. Well, I'll keep that in mind because I made the mistake of ordering it, I guess, from your thieving agent. So so I'll order a JFKII copy as well. But
I'm pleased to hear he delivered it. That at least, I mean, he's not only thieving, he's insanely incompetent. But he delivered yours. That's good.
Yes. Yep. And JFK Jr. as well.
Oh, terrific.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, so people should go to Amazon and search for JFKII and help to fund the work. Absolutely incredible conversation, and I'll be happy to talk to you again in the future. So thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you so awfully much.